Every step in the progress of the world has been a new control. It has been escaping from the tyranny of a fact to the understanding and mastery of that fact. For ages, man looked up in terror at the lightning flash. Today, he has begun to understand it as electricity, a force he has mastered and made his slave. The million phases of electrical invention are but manifestations of our control over a great force. But the greatest of all control is self-control. At each moment of a man's life, he is either a king or a slave. As he surrenders to a wrong appetite, to any human weakness, as he falls prostrate in hopeless subjection to any condition, to any environment, to any failure, he is a slave. As he, day by day, crushes out human weakness, masters opposing elements within him, and day by day recreates a new self from the sin and folly of his past, then he is a king. He is a king ruling with wisdom over himself. Alexander conquered the whole world except Alexander. Emperor of the earth, he was the servile slave of his own passions. Any man may attain self-control if he only will. He must not expect to gain it save by long-continued payment of price in small progressive expenditures of energy. Nature is a thorough believer in the installment plan in her relationships with the individual. No man is so poor that he cannot begin to pay for what he wants. And every small individual payment that he makes, nature stores and accumulates for him as a reserve fund in his hour of need. With nature, the mental, the physical, or the moral agency he expends daily in right doing is all stored for him and transmuted into strength. It is only the progressive installment plan nature recognizes. No man can make a habit in a moment or break it in a moment. It is a matter of development, of growth. But at any moment, man may begin to make or begin to break any habit. Now, this little piece was written in 1905, hence the reference to lightning and the manifestations of electricity. If Mr. Jordan, the author, William George Jordan, could hold an iPhone in his hand, he might be amazed at the mastery that we have accomplished in terms of electronic gadgetry, wouldn't he? This was excerpted from his book, Self-Control, Its Kingship and Majesty. Quite an interesting metaphor, isn't it? And, of course, self-control is one of the what? Fruits of God's Holy Spirit. And as we exercise this fruit, we are posed with a constant challenge. For we are confronted in every minute of every day to choices that we must make in response to a variety of internal and external forces, dynamics, stimuli, call it what you will. Building self-control is a lot like building up a muscle. You have to use it to strengthen it. And the repetition of lifts or reps will help you do the job. And, of course, as Mr. Jordan pointed out, Habits are made by repetitive actions and repetitive wise choices when you are exercising prudence and self-control in your life. Let's take a look at Galatians chapter 5, where the fruit of the Spirit is listed. Galatians 5. Familiar territory. In fact, it appears to be the last fruit of the Spirit. In verse 23, right after gentleness and self-control. But you know, it's a funny thing about self-control. It plays into almost everything we do as a human being, doesn't it? Because if you look at the works of the flesh, which are listed in this same segment of Scripture, beginning in verse 19, the works are what? Adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies. Woo! It depresses one just reading that list, doesn't it? But when you think about it, doesn't self-control play into all of those? What about adultery? Ask David if self-control plays into adultery. Self-control plays into almost every aspect of our lives, doesn't it? Because our adversary has a billion different devices. And he will try every means that he can to tempt you, to confuse you, to lure you, to tell you that God doesn't know what he's talking about. This won't hurt you. This hot stove will not burn you. You can touch it. You can pick it up and hug it. It won't hurt you. Oh, yes, it will. He used the same theory in the Garden of Eden. Self-control has been a challenge for human beings from the start. And if you're like me, your self-control has been challenged about a dozen times already today, and the day isn't even over. And I failed already in several counts. I became a slave a couple of times already today, even though I want to be a king. All of us want to be kings. And in fact, every year at the feast, we hear, especially in the fall festival, right, about becoming kings and priests and reigning with Jesus Christ. And all of us wonder, well, how can I become a king? I've not even been elected to a political office. I don't know anything about ruling cities and tribes and all the rest of it. Well, guess what? One of the highest quality characteristics of a wise ruler and king will be what? Self-control. Self-control. And when you look back at some of our presidents, you can see some who exerted a large degree of self-control, and there are those who exhibited very little self-control. Speaking, of course, of our national presidents, our nation's presidents. It is so easy for us to rationalize, justify, and excuse our behavior when it comes to making choices in life. And exercising self-control is never easy. And in fact, releasing ourselves to do whatever we feel like, what we would really like to do, is far easier than restraining ourselves in most cases. So this afternoon, I'd like to take a look at this very important fruit of God's Holy Spirit. And as we do, let's all remind ourselves how important it is for us to choose to be a king. I think it's an interesting way to look at it. And when you're confronted with a challenge, when somebody says something that makes you angry, what will you do? Will you bow to anger? Or will you resist it and push away and rise to be a king? Which will it be? And sometimes when we are stricken with these decisions, we hardly have a split second to ask ourselves that question, do we? Will we be a servant or what am I going to be in this case? No, we're already 10 miles down the road towards enslavement. And before we even ask if we're going to be a king in this case. So I'd like us to think seriously about putting that in the memory bank and using that when we're confronted with challenges that test our level of self-control. Let's begin this afternoon by turning to a few Proverbs. In the book of Proverbs, what a coincidence, that deal with self-control. My favorite of all is in Proverbs 16. Proverbs 16, verse 32. Now, if only we believe this. Now, in theory and in principle, all of us sitting here in these soft chairs or hard chairs, maybe where you are, all of us are in church. We're best in our Sabbath best, and we are here to worship God, and we're thinking spiritual thoughts, and we're saying, yes, this verse is right. But when we are under fire, and when it comes crunch time and decision time, do we choose to be a king, or do we choose to be a slave? Listen to verse 32, Proverbs 16. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. Even better than Alexander the Great, who perhaps should have been called Alexander the Diminutive or the Small. Do you really believe that anger is better than being mighty? I hope not. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. You know, men especially have trouble with this, don't we? A lot of times might is right. And many times, as the second portion of the verse implies, we can lose control of our spirit. We can get angry. And we can exercise might and power and authority. And for men, sometimes that feels very good, even if it's only over the cat or the dog, because you've had a hard day and you just want to explode and let that energy out and lose control for a minute. The blood rises and the little thermometer bulb up here turns red, and you start saying things and doing things you shouldn't say or do, and there's a sense of might and power and control. But I'm afraid you're not really mighty. You're enslaved right now. You're subject to something else. You're not in control. You're subject to anger. You're subject to your emotions. You're not controlling yourself. Get a grip would be good advice. But men are not the only ones that have issues like this. Women can have them too. I don't want to be prejudicial here. Now, if we only believe this, and if we act it as though we believe that being slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit, better than someone who conquers a city and rules it. Now, when you think about that, Napoleon conquering all those cities and ruling them, the Roman Empire and all of their Caesars and all of the pomp and circumstance that goes with ruling a conquered city. You parade the slaves down Main Street and everybody cheers you because you are the conqueror. But someone who can control their own spirit and rule it as a king is better than he who takes a city. And as I said, we can sit here and we can say, that's absolutely right. But when we get in a pressure situation, suddenly our anger can get the best of us. We can lose our self-control, and we forget about the need to ask ourselves the question, will I be a king or will I be a slave? Which will it be? As I said, sometimes we are already a slave before we even have a chance to ask ourselves the question. Anger and the expression of force and authority are often attractive options,
But this is not what kings do. Kings have their self under control. Proverbs chapter 12. Proverbs 12. A couple more Proverbs here. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge. I'm reading from the New King James, but he who hates correction is stupid. I don't know that I have ever seen that word appear in any translation that I've ever read. But here it is in the New King James. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. How about this test of your self-control? Mr. or Miss Know-It-All comes to you and begins to tell you how much they know and how little you know. What does that do to your buttons, to your cranks, to the mechanism that controls you? What are you prone to do? You are prone to immediately, at least in your mind, begin to question their authority to even come to you and say these things. Why are they saying these things? And if you're not careful, some of that will come out of this opening in the front of your face, and you will say some things. You may even do some things. You may even reach out to touch them in inappropriate ways by strangling them because you are angry and you're frustrated. And you, why are they saying this? I know this, and I already know that, and don't they think I know anything? Which may be closer to the truth than any of us want to admit, right? Because when we're in a situation like this, suddenly our anger explodes, and we get on the defensive, and we don't want to learn anything, especially about our own insufficiencies. That's the worst topic that we could imagine discussing with someone else. And so suddenly, we are not one who loves instruction and loves knowledge. To be a lover of instruction and knowledge, you have to be open to it. Are you open to listening to a Mr. or Miss Know-It-All? Are you open to exercising self-control and exercising that kingly attitude and not descending into slavery? Think about it. You and I are tested virtually every day in so many different areas. And if you don't believe me, just spend tomorrow up here. And as you go about your daily routine, think about kings, slaves. Where am I? What am I thinking about now? How did I respond when my wife said that to me? How did I react when I got that email? What am I going to do now that the dog dug under the fence again and made a mess? How am I going to respond to my son who wants another $1,000? What will I say? How am I going to react? Will I be a king or will I be a slave? Just spend a day at it, and I think you'll discover what I have, what I think all of us will. We are challenged in terms of our self-control, and many times we become slaves instead of kings. Proverbs 19. Verse 11. The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. That's a good choice. And his glory is to overlook a transgression. How hard is that? How hard is that? You know, human nature is usually in the entrapment mode. We are eager to trap someone in a misdeed or a transgression. And that tends to be more our habitual way of thinking. And if we see someone doing something wrong, There it is. I'm going to bring that up to them. I'm going to make sure that other people know about it. You see, and we've all been there. We've all heard the rumors. We've all thought the rumors. We've all had these attitudes toward other people and their transgressions. Perhaps they brought one of our transgressions to our attention, and so we are on the lookout for one of theirs. And if we can capture that, then we are not going to overlook it. And where am I going with this? Am I a slave or am I a king? What would a king do? A king would overlook it. Now, am I saying overlook bank robberies and adultery? And no, I'm not saying that. I think we all know that there are many times that had we overlooked some little slight, some inconsequential comment or situation, that there would not have been World War III as a result. If we just could have zipped, not said anything, gone about our daily business, not turned around and confronted the situation, but kept walking, not let it ruffle our feathers, it would have gone away. Because remember, what you feed will survive, and what you starve will die. So we have choices to make, don't we? The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. And his glory, that kingly virtue, is to overlook a transgression. Overlook a transgression. So now I'd like to spend a little time looking at three or four biblical examples here in which people had to make choices. Let's go to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew 15. This is a very familiar account of the Gentile woman who came to Christ with her demon-possessed daughter. I'll tell you right now, I could never have held up under this kind of fire. I would have lost control early on. This is one of the most remarkable examples of self-control I've ever read about, ever encountered. I think you will probably agree. I want you to put yourself in the position of this woman, this Gentile woman, with a severely demon-possessed daughter. She's coming before Christ and asking him to heal her daughter. Now, you tell me if she was a king or a slave. And in fact, Christ essentially crowned her, didn't he, at the end, as queen, if you will, queen for a day, queen of queens, because of her faith. And her faith was emphasized and shown by her what? By her self-control. Because had she thrown up her hands, had she made a contrary comment and walked away, what would have happened? The outcome may have been entirely different. I have no idea. I have no idea. But let's read. We all, I think, can see the picture forming here. It won't take long to go through these few verses. Then Jesus, verse 21, went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." What a tragic situation. How sad. But, verse 23, he, that is Jesus, did not answer her, not a word, ignored her. And as soon as the disciples saw Christ's response, and I'm not criticizing Christ's response, far be it from me, he was testing her faith. He admitted it later. I'm sure that's the option that he was exercising there. But his disciples, as soon as he did not respond to her, what did they say? "Send her away. She's crying after us. What a noise box. We don't need this. We've got better things to do. Send the woman and her daughter away." Ah. Doesn't she know who we are? Plus, that's a Gentile. We don't have any dealings with them. So the disciples were not acting very well, were they? Now, he, Christ, answered and said, finally, to the woman, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's where he was going. She was a Gentile. Now, Christ made that statement for a reason, and she proved her mettle, and her daughter was healed. I want you to keep that bottom line in mind. And how would you feel now at this point? First, you probably heard the disciples saying, send her away, out of here. And now Christ says, well, I'm not sent to your kind. I've been sent to the house of Israel. How would you feel? Well, imagine yourself in that situation. It would be very uncomfortable. What would you say? How would you react? Where would your self-control be? Would you be moving towards slavery at that point and letting your emotions rule you? What did she say? I think she put in motion that last proverb we read. If you overlook something, she overlooked it, didn't she? What did she say? She simply said what? Lord, help me. How could you resist that? Well, Christ does not resist it, but he takes it one step further. He answered and said, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. How would you feel? What would you say? What would you do? Would you storm off in a huff? Would you pick up stones and start throwing them? Would you start justifying yourself and decrying the insult that was just given to you from your perspective? Or would you overlook it and continue to act, what, like a king? She said, yes, Lord, that is true. I affirm what you're saying. Yet, even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Undoubtedly, Christ knew the mettle of this woman, what she was made of, what she was capable of doing. He healed her daughter based on the profound expression of faith. O woman, great is your faith. And had she walked away at the first offense, had she walked away at the second offense, where would she be? Where would her daughter be? Overlooking, moving forward, responding with love and respect, not losing your temper, self-control, controlling all those emotions that are alive and well in us. What a challenge. Did this woman rise to kingship? Queenship, if you will? I think she did, didn't she? And her daughter was healed from that very hour. I wonder if the disciples even learned a lesson on this one. Maybe we spoke too soon here. And what a marvelous example, once again, of someone who exercised self-control. Now, 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel 24, this is King David. I referred to this earlier, 1 Samuel 24. Excuse me, I want to go to make sure I have the right reference here. Yes, 1 Samuel 24, verse 3. I had not referred to this earlier. I got these two turned around. In verse 3 of 1 Samuel 24, so he came to the sheepfolds. This is Saul.
He's in pursuit of David. David's hiding in a cave. You probably remember this account. And here comes Saul. He has to relieve himself. This is how it reads in the King James, New King James. He went in to attend to his needs. So he was using the restroom in the cave, if you will. And when David and his men hunkered down in the cave, huddled back in the darkness, saw who it was and what he was doing, what did David's men say to him? Now's your chance. Here is your enemy. God has delivered him to you. He is indisposed at the moment. He will be an easy target. Go for it. And David did what? Well, he took his sword. He was hesitant. He approached Saul and he cut off the corner of his garment. Probably from behind, right? Saul was busy. He was occupied. So Saul hitched up his breeches and went outside. And David's conscience smote him. He came out and called out Saul's name and essentially apologized for what he had done and asked Saul why he was chasing him, a little flea, a little bug. He was the Lord's anointed, and David was repentant. Look in verse 10. Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you, but my eyes spared you, and I said, I will not stretch my hand out against the Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. So David slipped a little bit, just that little corner of the garment, and then he retreated, and he acted like what? A king. Now, he acted like a slave there for a split second, but he pulled back. And sometimes we're going to be acting somewhere in the middle, right? A little bit kingly and a little bit slavish. But being a king means making the right choice consistently. David did in this case, but here's another case where he didn't make the right choice in 2 Samuel 11. 2 Samuel 11. Now it happened one evening, verse 2, that David rose from his bed and walked out on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. Who was this woman? Bathsheba. Now, what would a king do? Now, it just so happens David was a king. What would a king do? A king would turn his head and go back downstairs, wouldn't he? But David did not. David became a slave. And he called for Bathsheba. He had relations with Bathsheba. He had her husband murdered. He lost a son over it. Solomon was born to Bathsheba. Later on, he lost another son, Absalom. There was anarchy and upheaval in the kingdom, and Absalom tried to overthrow his father, and all of that began on the rooftop in the dark as David succumbed to his fleshly lust and desire and took another man's wife. Self-control was not there. He behaved like a slave, and he was enslaved by his emotions and committed a grievous sin. Let's take a look at one more example in 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5. Verse 1. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper as well. So here's Naaman. He was commander of the army for the king of Syria, a very powerful personage, mighty in victory, but he was also a leper. And of course, leprosy was a terrible disease. It still is in some parts of the world a major health risk and factor. But of course, he wanted desperately to be healed. And it so happened that a slave from Israel mentioned to him that there was a prophet in the land of Israel that could heal him, and his name was Elisha. So, being desperate to rid himself of leprosy, the commander of the army of Syria gathered together some of his servants, some of his soldiers, gifts and other supplies that would be necessary for the journey, and he journeyed to the land of Israel and searched out the home of Elisha. Verse 8. So it was, when Elisha the man of God heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." See, the king was very upset, because he thought it was a plot by the king of Syria. Okay, I'm going to send the leader of my armies over, and if this guy Elisha doesn't heal him, we're going to come in there and destroy you guys. So the king got all upset. Elisha said, "Don't worry, let him come." So here comes Naaman. Verse 9. He went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. Now try to imagine this. This is a conquering general. He's probably got a whole host of horses and chariots and mules laden with precious gifts, all kinds of accoutrements that he would travel with. He would not travel with a backpack and a sleeping bag. This is the high and mighty general of the Syrian army. And he is a leper. And he is desperate to be healed. He is used to people waiting on him. He is used to giving orders. He is used to doing things his way, which most generals are. And it seems that our human nature becomes more entrenched in emotional response the higher up the success ladder we travel. In other words, our self-control seems to diminish or grow smaller as we grow larger in our own eyes. And we become more demanding and more insistent and more enslaved to our emotions and more impressed with ourselves than we would if we were not as inflated. And sadly, this is the way it was with Naaman. And you wonder if being a king got to David a little bit, and he could choose whatever woman he wanted. And, of course, in those days, essentially, men did that. But God was not pleased in David's case. So this is a fascinating account. Naaman is standing there. I'm sure he's on his horse, you know, in all his glory. Let's put it that way. Now catch what Elisha does. This is fascinating. Elisha sends a messenger out to Naaman. Elisha doesn't even show up. This is Naaman. Do you know who I am? Remember that phrase? Elisha simply said, "Go wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean." Well, sounds simple enough, right? Go wash 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be just like a baby's bottom. Just pure and pink, just like new. Well, of course, Naaman was ecstatic, wasn't he? So very pleased that he was going to be cured. Now, why is it that the person that can control themselves is greater and mightier than the person who takes a city? Why is that? Well, here you have a living color example of why that is. And it takes one of his servants to point this out to Naaman. because he is so angry, he can't see straight. It says in verse 11, Naaman became furious. Absolutely furious. Not just upset. Furious. Here's a general. Do you want to confront a furious general with all of these troops at his beck and call? He became furious. And he went away. Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me. That's the least he can. Doesn't he know who I... Won't he even come out here? And he will stand and call on the name of the Lord, his God, wave his hand over the place, do something dramatic, call down fire and lightning and brimstone. And heal me of the leprosy. In other words, I was expecting something more dramatic than his servant coming out and telling me to go wash in that mud hole of a river. Which is what he says in the next verse. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Ridiculous. Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he's really upset. I'm not going to... The Jordan River? If I just came here to get wet, to take a bath, I could have done that back home. I'm getting out of here. This is ridiculous. Of course, he's still what? A leper. Now, it calls to mind the Gentile woman and her discussion with Christ. She overlooked some things. She humbly kept coming and imploring Christ, and, of course, her faith was evident. Who has more self-control? This Gentile woman with her daughter who's demon-possessed, or the mighty Naaman? Well, the answer is obvious, isn't it? Now, verse 13, his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father. Now, you can imagine, he's probably about 13 shades of purple right now, stomping off, let's get out of here. And they come up very cautiously, my father, now listen, if he had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? So you see, now they're asking him to grab a hold of yourself. Get some control back here, Naaman. If he had asked you to do something great, wouldn't you have done it? What would Naaman have to say? Well, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. So how much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So think about it, Naaman. So now he's starting to come down off of his emotional high. Remember how, you know, violence and taking that city and stomping on people who don't do the right thing and, you know, I'm the boss here, that kind of attitude enslaved him. So now he's calming down. He went to the Jordan. So that must have been a big crow feast for him. He went to the Jordan. Now think about this. I can't know exactly what happened, but I have a hunch. He's probably going there against his better judgment, but his servant said, why don't you try? We always like to save face, don't we? When we know we've blown it, we try to save face and put a little better construction on. Okay, I'll go, but I really don't like this. This is not going to work. Why would he say seven times? Well, it's the number of completion. I don't know why he said seven times. But think of yourself as Naaman. You go down the first time. Oh, I look like an idiot. Everybody else is out. All of my soldiers, my servants are out there. I'm here in this muddy river. I'm dipping down once. I'm soaking wet. I'm still leprous. I'm supposed to do this six more times. And so down he goes, and down he goes, and down he goes. And finally, the seventh time, he comes up. Bingo. No more leprosy. No more leprosy. He was clean. And he returned, verse 15, to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him and said, indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. And, of course, Elisha said, I can't take anything. But Gehazi went running after them and said, well, yeah, I'll take a few things. And that's another story. Gehazi wasn't in a kingly mode either, was he? He let his greed get control of him. So the mighty usually find it a little more difficult to choose to be a king. Quite an example here, isn't it? Now finally, let's turn to the example of Jesus Christ in Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4. You know, Satan here, of course, is tempting Christ. Satan tempts us all. And he tempts us with clever arguments that are designed to manipulate our choices and direct us toward ungodly conduct. I want you to imagine the strength of character necessary for Jesus Christ to make these choices, the strength of character that would be necessary for you and me to make these choices. And truly, Christ responded as a king in every case. You recall he fasted 40 days, he ate nothing, and then he confronted Satan in the wilderness. How hungry would you be after 40 days? I would be dead after 40 days. Although I probably have enough stored up to last for 39. He was definitely hungry. And what was the first temptation that Satan placed before him? And all in the context of doing something godly, if you will. If you are the Son of God, if you really are who you say you are, if you really have this power and you are of God, then it should be easy for you to satiate your hunger right now by turning these rocks into bread. How tempting would that be? Very tempting after 40 days. Christ reacted as a king would. He answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God. Of course, he was not going to bow the knee to Satan, and turning those stones into bread would have done so. And he was not going to bend. He was not going to break. He was going to answer as a king would answer. His self-control was intact. It was honed to a sharp edge by 40 days of fasting and drawing close to his father, recognizing the monumental battle that would be underway in the wilderness. The stakes were high, and he was there. And he responded like a king. Despite the fact that eating some bread would have been a very comforting thing at the time. And once again, put yourself in a situation like this. It's usually easier for us to let go of our self-control than it is to hang on to it and exercise it, isn't it? The second temptation. He took him up to a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to him, all this authority I will give you and their glory, for this has been delivered to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. Therefore, if you will worship before me, all will be yours. Interesting admission by Satan the devil. And how many millions of Christians have overlooked this verse, read right through it, and not realized what it said? I was one of them 45 years ago. This world is mine. The glory of all of these kingdoms belongs to me. I can give it to whomever I wish, and I will give it to you if you bow down and worship me. Well, Christ answered and said, get behind me, Satan. It is written, You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. So once again, he could have, in theory, escaped the crucifixion, right? And escaped all those unpleasantries and inherited the entire world and all of its kingdoms. The kingdoms of this world would be his, and he wouldn't have to go through the horror and the agony that was in front of him. Well, of course, that never would have happened. That never would have happened. Not with Satan offering that kind of promise. The point is, Christ did not bend his self-control as a human being, if you will. Was intact, was supreme, and he denied Satan that opportunity as well. Then he took him up to the pinnacle of the temple. He said, if you are the Son of God, again causing him to question who he was. And Christ thankfully knew exactly who he was. But you know, in having given up the position at the right hand of his Father, having become a human being, God in the flesh, if you will, Emmanuel, God with us, was Satan trying to infuse some kind of confusion and disorientation, trying to get him to wonder about who he really was and entice him to prove this to me, Christ? If you really are, then you should be able to throw yourself down and angels will catch you and you won't be harmed. So go ahead and do it. I don't believe you are who you say you are. And a lot of times, especially young men, can be taken in by some kind of bold challenge to their masculinity or their authenticity or their honesty or their manhood or whatever, and they go out to prove something. Well, Christ didn't buy that either. But once again, just an example of what self-control looks like coming from a king. He was not going to be enslaved by Satan the devil, as human nature essentially has become. That's why it's such a struggle for us to exercise self-control. He quotes two scriptures to encourage Christ to tempt God by throwing himself down. But Christ quoted scripture once again and said, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God." So the devil ended every temptation and departed from him. Thankfully, it was over. That battle was over. And the king won because the king exercised self-control and did not bow to the temptation or the emotion or the hunger or the possible vanity of inheriting all of this without going through the suffering. All of these things were confronted by Christ and dealt with. That's why the person who is in control of their spirit, who has self-control, is mightier than he that takes a city. So as we conclude this afternoon, isn't this one way to examine ourselves prior to Passover? How much of this fruit of the Spirit do each of us have? And remember how pervasive self-control really is as a fruit in our daily lives. How often and how frequently and intensely we need to grab a hold of ourselves and get control. Because who else wants control? Of course, our adversary. And he wants to lead us and guide us, even as he attempted to guide and lead Christ toward making false assumptions and wrong decisions. And enslave us. That's what he wants to do. And we are not slaves to sin. We have been freed from that, and we have to fight for our freedom daily by exercising self-control. So, what will you be? A king or a slave? Remember, if you want to be a king tomorrow, you must start today. So choose to be a king by exercising self-control.